When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
But they're looking for that, let alone chasing it. It's gone straight into the confectionery stall and out again.
And his Boldum, that surely is going to be it. A joyous, triumphant Boltham there. Palms aloft again, 121 for 9.
Boltham on 99, Hughes the bowler. Straight down the ground, beautifully played, and that brings up Ian Botham's century. This really has been a magnificent batting performance by one of the greatest all-rounders of all time.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, an Analyst Inside Cricket special today, because Tuesday the 24th of November is a red letter day. It's Ian Botham's 65th birthday. So we thought we'd do a special podcast all about Botham, the legend, the man, both on and off the field. We've got both Simon Mann and Hugh Turbeville, the managing editor of The Cricketer, on this particular podcast. And we've got Hugh on particularly because it was his idea, actually, to interview Ian Botham coming up to this very important day in his life. So we're going to talk to Hugh about the process of interviewing Botham and why he did so. We've also got some Botham talking about himself and Kathy, his wife, talking about what it's been like to live with him over the last 40 years or so. So a really interesting insight into Ian Botham, the man, the legend, the cricketer, and also now the winemaker. So Simon Mann first, what does Ian Botham say to you?
He says, fantastic cricketer, dominated the 1980s. I wonder if he would have been an even better cricketer if he'd played now.
And Hugh, you went up and interviewed him. So what about Ian Botham for you as a man, as a cricketer?
Scintillating cricket in the mid-80s, laudable charity work.
Yeah, well, that's good. We hadn't mentioned his charity work yet. Incredible contribution to leukemia research, of course. Lots of people I've spoken to, some of them sort of who weren't familiar with Botham as a cricketer because they're perhaps a little bit too young, sort of saying, well, why is he a lord? Well, why is he a lord? Not only because of his incredible contribution to English cricket and the world game, but also his 20 million that he's raised for leukemia research over the years with his charity walks. And it's turned a child's chance of surviving leukemia from 20% to 80% in that time. So his contribution to science and to the survival of the species, in a way, has been absolutely incredible. We'll get into the depths of this discussion in a bit about Ian Botham and the man and so on. But just to say a couple of things first, don't forget the live video stream that we're doing every Thursday in the Virtual Cricket Club. That's at worldsbestcricketclub.com. and that's this Thursday with Alistair Cook. We're really getting a lot of enthusiasm and interest in that club. Thursday night, 7 p.m, a live stream with a star player. You've got the chance to win memorabilia. You've also got the chance to actually ask direct questions to the star player that we feature. And I've created a WhatsApp group as well for sort of general day-to-day discussion about the game that we all love. So go to worldsbestcricketclub.com and you can join us for £6 a month, and you get lots of great assets and content for that little fee. And it goes to, the proceeds go to the Professional Cricketers Trust charity. So that's Alistair Cook this Thursday. And also just to say thank you to Beer 52, who are supporting this podcast with all their different craft beers from all over the world. We've been trying some on our virtual show, and I'll tell you, they are absolutely fantastic. Beer52.com/cricket, you can get 8 free beers, free craft beers, supplied for just £5.95 if you sign up. So that really is a good offer. Okay, so Ian Botham. Now, let's just talk about the stats for a minute first. If we just look at how he performed for England in his career, 102 tests, 5,200 runs, average of 33.54, 14 test hundreds. Now, that is an astonishing figure when you also factor in his 383 test wickets as well, at an average of 28.4, which, of course, at the time was a record for England, 383, which since only Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson have gone past. So a remarkable all-round record. And if you look at the ICC rankings, he's second in the all-time all-rounders list. No surprises who's first. Garfield Sobers, 669 points. Botham second, 645, followed by Callis, 615, and then Keith Miller, interestingly, 572. So, you know, he really is close to being the greatest all-rounder that's ever lived. Simon, what do you think about that?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think it's worth starting off with the point that anyone listening to this podcast, I reckon about under the age of 42, would have never seen Ian Botham play, certainly not in his prime. And he was a magnificent cricketer. Those sort of late years of 1970s as a bowler, he swung it at high pace. And then 1980s, he produced those tremendous innings, 1981, those incredible hundreds at Headingley, and probably an even better one at Old Trafford. He did dominate English cricket in the 1980s. You know, every sort of conversation about cricket in the 1980s sort of revolved around him. And it wasn't just on field, it was off field as well. There was plenty of controversies. I mean, I used to listen to Test Match Special. I used to hear Fred Truman talking about, you know, Keith Miller and the great Sir Leonard, and, you know, all those sort of things in the past. And it was fascinating because I never saw them play. But at least one thing now is we can go back and look at those events of 1981 and 1985 and all sorts of other incidents as well involving, because, you know, because of the advent of YouTube and video then. Because what we can't do is go back and see very much of, you know, Len Hutton play or Keith Miller play. Or my absolute favourite, I'd love to go back in time and watch the Bodyline series of 1932. We can't do that. But of course, even though you didn't see Botham play in the 1980s, you can watch him play on your screens.
And Hugh, you didn't actually see him play when you were, well, certainly not in his pomp, I suppose, because you're too young.
Headingley passed me by. I wasn't into cricket in 81. But I started watching Test cricket in 82, and yeah, I saw him hit 18 off 7 balls at Edgbaston in 1985. I stayed up, I think, or certainly watched the highlights the next day and watched him bash Murphy's around at Brisbane in 86-7. And I was enthralled when he came back from his drugs ban in 86 against New Zealand and took 2 wickets in his first 2 overs. So, yeah, I mean, I'm lots of exciting stuff, but I did miss his absolute peak, yes.
I actually was hugely influenced by Botham. I remember seeing him on telly, 1977, in his first test. And I was a compulsive test match viewer at the time. I would have been, say, 16. And I watched all summer test cricket on telly. In fact, I scored as well. I had a scorebook and I used to put, you know, dots and ones and twos and fours and things and sort of then type them up later. I was a real saddo in that sense. should have got out more clearly. And, you know, I'd use the lunch interval to then go and try the shots that I'd seen the players play, or the balls they'd tried to bowl. And both of them, what struck me actually was the sort of vigour that he had with the ball, really running in, charging in. He had quite a long run actually at the start, and then, you know, tried to swing it, tried to take wickets, as opposed to a lot of other typical English bowlers, like someone like Mike Hendrick, for instance, and a few others. You know, they just bowl sort of line and length. He really tried to take wickets by bowling full and trying to swing the ball both ways and trying to fox the batsman with a couple of outswingers and a big inswinger. And I also liked his slower balls that he tried. He bowled a little off break, and I really developed that myself. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to bat like him, but I tried to bowl like him. And amazingly, and I mean, this sounds bizarre now, but Mike Brearley, who was, of course, England captain at the time, he actually, when I first came into the Middlesex team, he said, you bowl like both of them. You know, he said, you bowl those swingers and you try and take wickets, and it's really exciting. And that was an incredibly nice thing of Mike Brearley to say. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily proved over the long period of my career. But he definitely was a massive influence in just the spirit and the adventure of his cricket.
One thing about him, Yoz, actually, it's easy to forget, is I actually first saw him bowl in 1976 in the Benson and Hedges Cup match. And on that occasion, he was probably bowling about your pace, actually. He was bowling, you know, he bowled medium pace. And then...
Oi, steady on.
within a couple of years, I saw him play a county match against Gloucestershire at Taunton on one sort of May Day bank holiday. And he was a completely different bowler from 2 or 3 years before. You know, he ran in and he bowled bouncers and he swung it at high pace. And for a couple of years, not only did he swing the ball, he was genuinely quick as well. But, you know, back in the mid-70s, he was sort of medium fast, really. He was a sort of medium pace swing bowler. He sort of totally transformed his game in the space of 2 or 3 years, which of course can happen to bowlers, isn't it? You can suddenly make huge step forwards at quite a young age over a relatively short space of time.
Yeah, Hugh, you had the idea to go and visit and interview both of them, which you've done, obviously, for the next issue of the Cricketer magazine. Go to thecricketer.com to see that, which is out this week, the December issue. So why did you decide to interview him?
He's the one cricketer that one of my heroes that I haven't really interviewed. I interviewed in recent years Gower several times and met him and been to his house. And Alan Lamb, who I think was marvellous. I met Gat and a lot of Graham Gooch interviews. So I think Botham was the one that was missing, really. And I thought, well, I need to get around to doing this because I've been writing about cricket for 20-odd years, and he's the one that's got away.
And what was it like interviewing him? You say that, you know, in your piece, actually, you say you should never interview your heroes. So what was the experience like?
Yeah, so he's so larger than life, isn't he? He was Sports Personality of the Year. He was a tabloid fodder. He was sponsored cars, and he's shredded wheat. He's an absolute giant of a man, and I always found him quite intimidating around the skybox. He'd come down from the commentary box and breeze past me, and I never sort of had the guts to talk to him. So I was expecting, I wasn't sure what to expect, really. I was expecting to be really intimidating, but actually he's quite kind and sort of generous with his time and patient with me, and very nice. And actually that's borne out by all the things that people have told me. I'm friendly with Derek Pringle, and he said that, you know, he's an absolute fantastic bloke to go out for a night with, and so generous with his time, and gregarious and effervescent, and David English has told me all about him. And very, very pleasant. Came across as a real sort of family man. And
I think generous is a really good word, actually. Certainly, that was my experience of him playing for Durham, that he looked after people really well. I'll tell you a couple of stories about that later, but let's hear from Beefy himself. We're going to join the interview with him talking about the 100, on which he was actually quite positive.
As chairman of Durham, there's a lot of interest. People want to know more about it, yeah. They want to play it. No, I'm very much in favour of the 100. Sometimes you need something that refreshes and changes. It's like changing a car. or buying a new house. You know, you effectively, we're looking at another way to develop the game, and I think it will have a lot of public interest. You're always going to get, when you move something away, you will always have someone objecting, because that's their way of life. It's their routine.
It's interesting.
Whereas I think sometimes you've just got to throw the wild card in, and I think the 100's the wild card.
We'll could Durham be in it? I mean, that could it expand to get Durham and Somerset in it? I know they want 8 teams, but...
But do you know what? I think it will evolve, and I think... But you've got to give it time.
Mm.
It's like, seed germinating. You've got to give it time.
Mm.
Because no one knows how it's going to be respected. But I think, certainly the people I've seen at Durham, there's a few that are a bit shaky about it, but the majority of people want to know more about it.
And they want to go. They will go to Leeds and watch the games. And,
I think so.
That's interesting. Stoke's captaincy, interesting. Like, you were captain, you've got so much on your plate as an all-rounder.
Mm.
And he's had a taste of it now with the first test. And he obviously made a couple of decisions. I mean, you live and breathe, die by your decisions, don't you? But do you think it's something he can do in the future?
I think that's something that he will only know.
Yeah.
With hindsight, I probably shouldn't have taken it at 24. But having said that, when the biggest accolade your country can bestow on you is the captain of your test side, and at 24 you jump at it. Also, everyone forgets, 12 of my 14 tests or whatever were against the West Indies home and away, and no one was beating them.
No.
So,
in fact, you were drawing, which is good effort compared to what
we lost 2-1, 2-0 and 1-0. So,
if it wasn't for Gower's catch at Trent Bridge.
Gower dropped that one, and he would have caught that 999 times out of 1,000. But no, we would have won that game, I think. But we didn't. But we were playing the best of the best, and I still think that the West Indian team of that era was the best that's ever played. I can't see anyone ever beat
better than McGrath and Warne.
Well, they've got four or five batsmen. Dujon at seven is a fantastic player.
Brilliant, man.
And you've got Haynes and Greenidge, probably one of the best combinations West Indies have ever had at the top of the order. Then there's a bloke called Richards, he wasn't bad. And then you've got Khalid Tran, then you've got Clive Lloyd, and then you got coming in at six, it could be Larry Gomes was the
thorn
in the side because he was a backline. And then they had a choice of about 12 bowlers, and they're all, majority of them, over 6 foot and quick. Whereas Malcolm's, Bacco was probably the shorter one, but a genius with the ball. So, and then people say, well, they can't be the best side in the world, they didn't have a spinner. Well, my answer to that is, when was the spinner going to bowl? So. Yeah, I think Clive Lloyd revolutionised the game in that period.
When would you have liked to have been captain, if not 24?
Well, probably 27, 28.
Right.
Which is where Ben's coming to, but...
Ashes 85 kind of thing.
Yeah, probably. But, you look back, to be honest with you, I wouldn't change anything.
No.
Great believer in things happen for a reason.
Right.
I enjoyed being the sergeant major or the enforcer for the team, dressing room, what have you. Played on many captains. I find it very difficult to go and pat someone on the back when they've just dropped the easiest catch in the world. I'd rather like to kick them up the backside and walk on. Whereas now I see these guys, they make a student statement, their boys all pat them on the back and everything. And I know what they're really thinking. It's something totally different.
I think Broad and Anderson show their annoyance, don't they?
Yeah. And I think they're entitled to, to be honest. When you've got two guys like Broad and Anderson and what they've done, I would give them a free rein. And I think they do pretty much.
Yeah.
But quite rightly, they've earned that right. It's so important that players... This is why I admire Ben. He's had his ups and downs, but he's being big enough and strong enough to get through them.
Mm.
And he is possibly one of the most exciting players in world cricket now, if not the most exciting. If you've got a day off and he's at home and he's not with the England squad, but obviously most of the time they're in these bubbles. But before then, he'd play a game for England, he'd be back up to Durham and he'd be in the dressing room with the boys the next day. How's it going, boys? Blah, 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 a bit of chat and everything. Mm-hmm. And that, I admire. Mm-hmm. I admire that. Whether he's as captain or as a sergeant major, take your pick, vice captain, whatever you want to call him. But that's a decision that he will make.
Mm.
And only he can make it.
So Botham, who, of course, one of the reasons we're doing this podcast today is because it's his 65th birthday and, a lot of people retire at 65, or they used to. No danger of Beefy retiring, a man of restless energy and enthusiasm, and really thrown himself into the job of being chairman of Durham, of course. And, you know, obviously, he sounds like a real advocate for the 100, Hugh, as well.
Yeah, and the Durham thing surprised me because I was expecting him just to be a sort of figurehead for Durham, but sounds like he replaced the board and brought the chief exec in. Tim Bostock was a minor counties cricketer who'd gone on to work for the Bank of Australia, and he both brought him back from Australia to be chief exec. So I was surprised at how hands-on he was about Durham and at Durham, and I was also very surprised about his views on the 100, because in the article, in the interview, he says that Test cricket's his thing and he hasn't really got that much time for much else, and he's been notoriously sort of lukewarm and ambivalent about T20. He's also now Durham chairman, and they're not in the 100. But in fact, he's actually very positive about it and a big fan of the 100.
Well, I think he sees its influence on the game as a whole, and the way it can drive up interest. But of course, he does also say that, you know, Test cricket is the be all and end all in the end, and if we didn't have Test cricket, the whole game would sort of die, he feels.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised by it. And I said to him, he said most of the Durham people, Durham fans, who talked to him about it are curious about it rather than aggressive. And I said to him, well, do you really think people will go from Newcastle to watch matches at Leeds? And he thinks they will. So, yeah, it just took me back a bit, I must admit.
Certainly, you know, he talks about Ben Stokes there and when and if would be the right time for him to be captain. Just looking at their comparative stats at the same stage in their career, Stokes has played 67 tests, 4,428 runs, 158 wickets. Both of them at the same stage, 3,800 runs, so 600 runs less, but 286 wickets, so 128 wickets more. So, you know, he was more of a bowling all-rounder, really. And I guess, you know, his career, it did go sort of a little bit fluctuating, didn't it? He sort of had that amazing sort of 1979, 1980, 81. And then it sort of dropped off a bit. And then he had a few issues with drugs and things like that. And he was suspended for a while and then came back with a bang. But perhaps wasn't quite as effective, certainly with the ball, as he had been in his pomp.
Well, I made the comment right at the start of this podcast that I wonder if he would have been an even better cricketer if he'd played now. And the reason I said that is because I think, you know, he had fitness issues. He put on weight and he had back problems and it hampered his bowling. And towards the end, you know, he went back to being that sort of that medium pace trunder, actually. I mean, it's hard to compare the guy who finished his test career with the one that was, you know, at his pomp 10 years before. Of course, you know, time ravages all of us. Although, you know, you look at someone like Jimmy Anderson, that hasn't happened, of course. And he's, you know, he's still a magnificent athlete and a magnificent bowler. So I just wonder, it's one of those sort of fascinations I have, because I mean, I loved watching him play. He was a fabulous cricketer. Bat and ball, and he was so excited. He could make things happen. He could catch as well. He was a brilliant slip fielder. There's that sort of nagging bit in me. If only he had a bit more discipline in his life, whether he would have been an even better cricketer, and whether actually now the structures that are in place now, you know, all the sort of demands, the fitness demands that they have on, you know, international cricketers now, especially in the England squad, whether he would have been able to sort of harness that and you know, still be the same cricketer. I mean, I think there's a feeling, and he might say it himself, that he had to live the way he did off the field. Him off the field and on the field was like the same being in a way, and that you couldn't have one without the other. I don't know whether, you know, you could have put more off-field discipline and that would have helped improve his game on the field even more. I don't know. But it's one of those things that's always fascinated me about him.
Yeah, I think, I mean, if I had to sort of try and sum him up, I think he to me, he was a gem who sparkled on the biggest of stages. So sometimes playing for Durham, which I did with him for 2 years, sometimes, you know, on a kind of fairly dead day somewhere, he wouldn't be that interested. But, you know, if there's a big crowd on a Sunday, wherever it was, whether it was in Darlington or Canterbury or, Derby and wherever, you know, he was really, sparky and brilliant. I have a few kind of moments. I just remember he was a match winner. He sensed the moment and he could really seize it. And of course, he did that famously in that 1981 Ashes series. But, you know, for Durham, you know, when he was very much past his best, he would still, there was our first ever game, Durham's first ever game, which was a Sunday League game against Lancashire at the Racecourse in Durham. It was 7-0. I was bowling the last over. Lancashire, a very good one-day side, had 7-0, only one wicket left. And off about the third ball, Beefy at mid-wicket pounced as they tried to get a single and hurled the stumps down. You know, absolutely brilliant. In a very tight NatWest game in the quarterfinals against Middlesex, he came in and played the decisive innings, sort of 70 not out or something, and saw us home. He also performed a brilliant run out in that game. I remember when Viv Richards came in to bat for Glamorgan. He was playing for Glamorgan that year. And when he came in to bat in a Benson Hedges game, you know, there was a hush around the ground because it was Viv striding out to bat. And Beefy said, you know, give me the ball, I'll get him. And even though he was only bowling at sort of 72 miles an hour, you could see Viv slightly in awe of Beefy, his great mate and his great sort of opponent. And although Beefy bowled this sort of fairly lollopy medium pacer, Viv tried to turn it sort of rather respectfully to leg and played a bit early. The ball looped off a leading edge, only about 10 yards in front of him, and Beefy kind of powered down the middle, leapt right out and stretched him and just one-handed plucked it off the ground. Brilliant catch, and got Viv out. So he, you know, he was just great at seizing the moment. And I mean, there are so many occasions when he was able to do that. The other thing about him, and just to go back, Simon, to your point about the fitness thing, you know, he was a great socialiser. And I think he inspired his teammates by this sort of camaraderie that he created around the team. And also, it had the opposite impact on the opponents because, you know, firstly, they could see this great sort of rousing camaraderie that he achieved. And secondly, he was able to, by his generosity of the parties that he threw, really undermining the strength and resilience of opponents by basically getting them plastered. And you know, sort of giving them, plying them with wine and food and so on, so that when after one of his famous parties they staggered off in the middle of the night, they couldn't perform the next day. Whereas he had, you know, an iron constitution, and he could. And I mean, I just one classic example of that was in a match during a 4-day game that we were playing against Essex, Durham against Essex, and he threw a party on the Saturday night, and we were having a 1-day game on the Sunday in the middle of the 4-day match, which was an absurd thing we used to do. And one of the people he managed to kind of completely reduce to, you know, wobbly legs was Graham Gooch, who wasn't a habitual drinker, but Beefy had sort of lured him into his lair. In fact, at one point he locked us in his cellar for about an hour because he wanted some of his red wine residue sort of drained. And I remember staggering out of his house and down the road to the hotel we'd stayed in for the night at about 4 a.m, and Graham Gooch was with me because we were staying in the same hotel. And Gooch, he sort of looked at me rather kind of bleary-eyed, and I said, you know, at 10:30 a.m, I'm going to be bowling at you because you're going to be opening the batting and I'm going to be opening the bowling. And he was sort of, oh, no, oh, God. Oh. And, you know, sure enough, 10:30 a.m, he staggers out the bat, literally doesn't lay a bat on the first over, LBW naught, last ball of the first over, and sort of staggers off. So, you know, that's one just isolated example of the impact that he could have on opponents.
So here's a question. If Both were playing now, how would that transform his cricket? How would he cope with the regimes and the greater discipline, the greater sort of... I mean, it wasn't as if he wasn't interested in fitness. I mean, he played professional football, for goodness sake, didn't he? Well, you know, you have to be fit to play pro football.
I think he trusted his skill, and yeah, I mean, he might have been able to bowl a bit quicker for a bit longer. You know, his body might have held up a bit more, but whether he could have contributed more with the bat, I'm not sure, because I think he put so much energy and vigour into his bowling, and he would bowl, you know, 30 overs in an innings. I think it's very difficult to then also be able to apply yourself with the bat for really long periods. So he had to be an impactful sort of batsman at number six. I don't think he could have played, for instance, the Ben Stokes innings at Headingley, which, you know, won that amazing game in 2019, which started as a real meticulous accumulation for a long time before it really exploded at the end. You know, Beefy probably wouldn't have been able to play that kind of innings, although, Hugh, you mentioned this, I think, in conversation earlier, he did block out a whole four-hour day in a match against Pakistan to save a test as well.
Yeah, 1987, him and Gatting batted the whole afternoon, didn't they, to save the match at the Oval. I think beer was his thing, wasn't it? I mean, what was interesting, I used to listen to Boycott on TMS, talking about both and the bowler, and I think they're friendly now, but I mean, there has been some antagonism between the two of them. Boycott's absolutely generous in his appraisal of both and the bowler, 77 to 81. As Simon said, he's you know, just swinging the ball at high pace, charging in, really high class. Boycott was saying a really high class performer, but I think he started putting on weight, didn't he? And I think John Lever told me that he switched to wine, or tried to switch to wine, in Australia in 82-3. Probably where the wine thing started, just to try and keep the weight down. So he was really struggling with the wine there. But on the batting front, there's that belligerent innings at Brisbane in 86-7. But yeah, he could do it. He could play that kind of Stokes innings. He did do that with that one time up against Pakistan. I mean, he used to madden me and my best friend, you know, we used to love him, about the way he'd give his wicket away. But I suppose that was his game, wasn't it? As you say, he'd come in and try and smash somebody out of the ground in the first over and get out. And it was maddening, but I suppose that's just the way he played, isn't it?
I suppose my question was, it wasn't so much how he would fit in and be able to do the things he did then now. It was more how he'd react to the sort of the greater discipline that he's, you know, forced on players now. I mean, you know, for example, not so long ago, I mean, during that Headingley series, there was a 12 o'clock curfew, wasn't there? Jack Leach was telling us about that last week on the Virtual Cricket Club. You know, he said after the victory at Headingley, that they all had to be in by 12 o'clock. You know, they wanted to go out and celebrate amazing victory, but no, it was 12 o'clock curfew.
Yeah. He wouldn't have it, Simon. I don't think he'd have it, would he? That 86-87 tour to Australia, England won everything and they were brilliant. But for the first 3 weeks, they all got annihilated, didn't they? And that was part of the management by Mike Gatting and Mickey Stewart. They gave them their head, but Botham himself, I think, come the first test, sat them all down in the dressing room and said, right, this is it. This is our time. Stop it now, you know. And of course, they probably picked it up again later when Elton John was being the DJ and they won the Ashes at Melbourne and everything. But I don't think he'd have that, would he? I think as part of the man management, you have to give people, you have to treat people differently. Don't you? I just don't see how both of them could have been curtailed.
Yeah,
like that.
I mean, it was more of a fun era, wasn't it? Cricket was still fun. And I'm not saying it's not fun now, but it's so much more scientific in a way now. And everybody has to sort of play their part and fit into that that sort of approach. Yeah. Then cricket was fun. And I think back actually to the incredible game he had in Mumbai, then Bombay, the test match in, I think it was 1980, when he took 12 wickets in the match and he scored 100, and it was, you know, baking heat as well. England won that test match, but he was up half the night with the famous Chris Crash Lander, who was the cricket correspondent of the Daily Mirror, drinking the beer that they'd imported from Australia, because they didn't want to drink Indian beer, because at the time, Indian beer wasn't too nice. So they brought a load of Castlemaine 4X or something from Australia, where they'd previously been, and just basically knocked that back during the night watching videos or something. So he hardly had any sleep, never mind the effort he put in on the field. It must have been exhausting, but he seemed to have this incredibly sort of cast iron constitution that enabled him to do it, and other people couldn't keep up with it. And of course, I tell that, you know, ridiculous story, which I'm not going to repeat again, but about you know, the fact that we had to almost have a rota system at Durham to go out with him at nights, because you couldn't possibly do it yourself every day because it was too tiring, too expensive.
David English was telling me that both him and Viv Richards, the King and I, did a speaking tour on what's called the King of I in Australia, and both of them is an insomniac, I think, or was, and didn't sleep at all. And so David English would have to stay up from 1 till 4 in the morning, and then Liv Richards would come down at 4 till 7 a.m. you know, just to keep the guy entertained.
Well, actually, that's true. And you know, I remember once again at Durham, we were staying in a hotel, I think at Leicester, and I'd gone to bed at about, you know, 11:30 or something, and my phone went at 2 o'clock in the hotel with the sort of, you know, bedside phone rang at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I got, you know how it's, sometimes you get those sort of palpitations when the phone goes late at night and you're worrying about it. Anyway, I answered it and it was a familiar voice. It's Beefy here. I've got a bottle of Beaujolais. I need to finish. And if you don't come round and share it with me, I'm going to come and beat the door down. So I got up and shared a sort of half a bottle of red wine with him at 2 o'clock in the morning because he couldn't sleep. So, you know, it was tiring, but entertaining, undoubtedly entertaining to play with him.
What was his best innings, Jos? We talked a bit about his bowling. We haven't really mentioned his batting that much. I mean, of course, there was Headingley 81. There was Old Trafford in 81. There was also that remarkable innings he played in a semi-final at Lord's against Middlesex, where he blocked out the last over against John Embry. The scores were level, but Somerset had lost fewer wickets, so they would go through. So he took the risk, rather than try to score the run against John Embry, just blocked out a whole over. No, of course, if he'd been out, then you know it would have gone the other way and Somerset could have well have lost the game. What do you remember about his batting?
A few things, actually. I'd certainly say his best two innings were the Old Trafford century against Australia in 81, where he totally destroyed the Australian bowling with wonderful clean hitting. It wasn't slogging. He was slogging a bit at Headingley in 81, whereas that innings at Old Trafford was really clean hitting, calculated assault. Also the innings in Brisbane, which Hugh mentioned in the 86-7 series, that sort of set England up so well in Brisbane, the gabatoir, and you know he really took the bowling attack on there. And one little innings I remember, you know, a match winning innings, which was extraordinary, was in a John Player League, a Sunday League game, when Somerset needed 15 off the last over, and he wasn't on strike. And the last over was bowled by Wayne Daniel, really, you know, viciously fast Barbadian. And Richard Harden was on strike and for the first two balls couldn't get off strike. And Beefy was at the non-striker's end, champing at the bit to get at the bowling. Eventually, off the third ball, Harden managed to scramble a 3 down to sort of, you know, deep mid-wicket or something. So Beefy was on strike, 12 to win from 3 balls. He hit the fourth ball miles over mid-wicket for 6. He then hit, I think, a 2 off the fifth ball and then hit the last ball for 6 again. A sort of low full toss, went miles over deep square leg into the crowd and they'd won the game. And, you know, it was when that was when you thought, if you didn't already think it, this guy's got the Midas touch. You know, he's just an absolute diamond who can win a game from unlikely situations.
To be able to hit the first ball he faces for 6, 85, Edgbaston, England were 440 for 4 or something, and he came in and smashed Craig McDermott for 6, first ball, over mid-wicket, and then he also hit the third ball for 6, and I've never seen anything like that. That's T20-style stuff now, isn't it, where you can just go in and do that from the off.
Mm. Yeah, but he had actually, although we're making him out as a bit of a slogger, I mean, he had a really good orthodox technique. I mean, he had a good defence. He played straight. He played back and forward. You know, probably his best shot was actually a kind of on the up through the offside, off the back foot. You know, he's a brilliant judge of height and length and just that tiny bit of width. And he could hammer it through the offside with actually great control. He used these enormous bats, which no one else could really pick up. And, you know, bowling at him in the nets, if he ever had a net, was seriously dangerous because, you know, it would come back at you so hard. But, I mean, I suppose in the end, you know, he's just someone who had this impact on a dressing room. I mean, you know, no target, no situation was beyond our team if he was in it. And he would be someone who would be saying, look, we can do this, you know, but, you know, leave it to me, lads. Oh, we'll do this. And it was just incredibly invigorating presence to have in the dressing room.
Yeah, you don't hear many people say, "Oh, yeah, I play with Ian Botham. God, it was a tedious experience." I mean, no one says that, do they? And I don't want to seem churlish by saying, "Oh, he could have achieved more." I mean, 14 Test hundreds and 383 wickets and whatever, however many catches it was, 100 catches, is just an incredible record. It was just phenomenal. It was a sort of treat, really, to be. As it is with Ben Stokes at the moment, to better watch that player play. It was a treat to watch Ian Botham play.
I think, Simon, though, you're right there, that if he hadn't been a bowler, he would have averaged a lot more than 33.5 with the bat. I mean, he would have averaged 40 plus, wouldn't he?
Yeah, and it's just...
I think he's probably good enough to be a specialist batsman, wasn't he?
Definitely.
Well, it's easy to forget as well. We talked about the hundreds at Old Trafford and Brisbane and Headingley. He also made a supremely assured double hundred against India at the Oval. It was a beautiful innings. It was almost a run of ball with clean striking, wonderful cricket shots. And that showed, he was perfectly capable of, as you say, of being a frontline batsman.
Well, Lamb averaged 36, and I think was Gatting 35. So,
yeah,
he wasn't far off.
No, I mean that era. Even Gooch, who was a tremendous player, one of the best England batsmen ever, he only averaged about 42. So it does show that averages were considerably lower then. So there is a person in his life who's been that stabilising influence throughout the roller coaster of his career, and that person, of course, is his wife, Kath, who married him very early on in his life, relatively speaking anyway, in his 20s, early 20s. And she's been an absolute rock for him. He would be the first to say that over the last 40-odd years. So I thought it'd be appropriate, actually, on the eve of his 65th birthday, to talk to her. And the first thing I asked her was, what are they actually going to do for his birthday?
Well, obviously, because we're in lockdown at this moment in time, I haven't really got anything in particular planned, apart from we are going to have an Indian from Babbles, which is a restaurant in Barnard Castle, which is quite a famous place now, post Dominic Cummings, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, it's a great Indian restaurant, slightly different kind of menu that you associate the normal traditional Indian restaurant with, and they have been brilliant over lockdown. And so, yeah, we're going to get a takeaway from there. So with the family, because we're very lucky, because Liam and his children live on the property. Sarah B and Arthur will be coming over because they're in our bubble. And Becky and Seb, because Becky works for us. So, yeah, we're all very lucky because we can have the family.
It's like a sort of early together. Christmas, isn't it?
It is really, yes. Yeah, but it's been, in that respect, it's been really nice.
Mm.
Yeah.
So go on, tell us what is the best and worst aspect of being married to the legend that is Ian Botham?
Yeah, well first and foremost, he's not a legend to me. Because you kind of, we met when we were very young. And got married, and against, I suppose, a lot of people's predictions back in the 70s, we're still together. And I don't know, really. I suppose in the early days, we spent the majority of our married life apart, which I suppose in one way has been quite helpful. It's only in the last couple of years that we've actually spent more time together. So... yeah, and it might have been a little bit taxing at times because he's, as you know, he's not the tidiest of people. We just get on. We like doing the same things, and you just kind of mold together as years go on. I think that's the secret.
And when you say he's not the tidiest, I mean, has he improved in that sense? Have you managed
to...
Well,
Do you know what? I have, after 40-odd years, got him to lift his plate up after he's finished eating with his knife and fork and walk over to the dishwasher. And his excuse for not putting it in the dishwasher is he can never tell whether it's on or not. So I haven't quite got him to open the dishwasher door and put the plates in yet, but I'm working on it. It's work in progress.
Phil Tufnell was on our show a couple of weeks ago, and he said that one of his secrets about dishwashers is have two, because there's always one that's empty.
They've got two in the barn, but in our kitchen, no, there's only one. Yeah.
I'll have to
get a new kitchen put in then, won't I?
Well, that sounds like a good thing to do for the next few years. What's he like to live with? I mean, go on. I mean, what's the best aspect of being with him? I mean, is it his energy? Is it his sort of optimism? Is it his contacts?
Over the years, I mean, you know, looking back, it's been great. I mean, met so many different people from all walks of life. One thing about us as a couple, we have friends, a lot of them in the farming community round here. We've known them, and Ian goes off fishing and shooting with them. We enjoy times up in Scotland when the boys go off and do their various pursuits and the girls go off and, go to the castles and the beautiful places, the gardens and everything. So from that point of view, it's been great with the type of friends we've met over the years. And, I mean, that's helped in these uncertain times at the moment.
And as far as sort of his personality, what's one thing, if you could say that, he's 65, so,
yeah,
you know, he's a mature man now. What would be the one thing you could say to him on his 65th birthday? Can you please just do this a bit more?
Oh.
Load the dishwasher, maybe.
Probably the dishwasher. Yeah, just sort his clothes out. He hates doing that. Everybody, when you listen to what people have been doing over lockdown and everything, you hear about that they've kind of gone into the wardrobes and shelves and had a really good clear out. Well, he keeps promising to do that, but we're not getting very far with it. So I think from the Botham household, we need lockdown to go on for the next few years for him to do that. That is the one thing. But on a more positive note over the years, I think one thing that people who know Ian always comment on is loyalty. He's a loyal person. It's not always repaid, I have to say. There've been moments when I got infuriated with other people because he is so, so loyal to both people and companies and organisations. And it hasn't always been reciprocated. But I think that's it. That nowadays, loyalty is something that you have to treasure with a person, I think.
And is he still sort of restless? Is he still got that sort of energy where he just wants to do things all the time?
Yeah, which has been a little bit difficult. But he's been, to be honest, he's been really quite happy spending time with his grandchildren. He's a great granddad. By his own admission, he wasn't a brilliant father because he was never around very much and focused on, obviously, his sport and things like that. But his grandchildren, he's a doting granddad. Mm. I think he would, I mean, people will dispute this, but from my point of view, I think he would win all the awards for the best granddad because he just loves having his grandchildren around. And we've got eight of them. We've got seven grandsons and one granddaughter.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And James, and how's he going to feel about James playing against his country on Saturday?
He's already been looking on the Welsh website for a red top. So there you are.
Wow.
I think that answers the question.
I thought you said he was loyal.
Well, yeah.
Loyal to family comes first, I suppose.
Absolutely, family always comes first, yeah. Yeah, we're so proud. So proud. The whole family is. And we just watched something on a link this morning of him actually receiving his cap in the dressing room afterwards. And, it was lovely. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. I was so nervous. So all last week, I mean, because we kind of knew slightly before everybody, you know, the other people until it was made, you know. So we had to kind of, once again in our lives, keep a bit mum. But it was, as time went on, as it got nearer and nearer, I was getting so nervous. And I thought, this is just reminiscent of watching Liam play when he was down at Cardiff and then got picked for England. And then, of course, all those years of watching Ian play for England and sitting, you know, before lunchtime at a test match, praying that a wicket wouldn't go down and Ian would have to come in, because I knew that the beautiful lunches that we used to have, which were, you know, was one of the the best things in those days as a wife, I wouldn't be able to eat it if Ian was coming into bat.
Well, listen, tomorrow should be a celebration for you as well, because
absolutely.
behind every successful man is a fine woman, yes?
Oh, yes, of course, yes, yes. Yeah, I think so, yes.
She's a saint, Kath, actually, over her life. She's been just a wonderful support to him and a voice of reason at times, which he's needed, of course. And actually, somebody who I think has helped him in his later life, in the charity, actually, Hugh, because, you know, this incredible contribution he's made to leukemia research with the walks he's done. And she's obviously been in the background and often in the foreground, sort of organising everything as well, and with the rest of his family.
Yeah, well, she made a good point when I was talking to her and trying to liaise for the interview, because she's sort of his manager, I think, or set these things up. That I said, is it 20 million? Is the latest figure 20 million that they've raised for leukemia? And she said, well, at least, but it's just raised awareness, you know. It's not, you can't put a figure on it. It's raised awareness for leukemia and the charity, and it's so much more than just that 20 million. But it's a humbling story, isn't it? Because he was in hospital for a broken toe, and he was taken through a ward, and he asked what all these young men were doing in the hospital beds, and he was told that they had a couple of weeks to live. So he decided that he'd devote all his time and for these walks to help people. It's incredible. And I think the younger generation, I sound like younger generation, I never thought I'd say something like that, but they forget this. They're unaware of this. So when there was a discussion about me going up to speak to both, I mean, there is some resentment, I think, about Brexit, if I'm honest, and his views on the House, you know, what his elevation to the House of Lords, and the sniping on Twitter about him. But you know, they forget that he's done these incredible deeds, and even if you don't disagree, even if you disagree with somebody's politics, can you not look beyond that anymore?
Yeah, good point. Actually, I went on a couple of his walks, and he was always very keen to badger his teammates into joining him, and we couldn't resist. We couldn't say no, given the commitment he puts in. But it's only when you actually go on one of these walks you see what he actually does do on a daily basis. So he will always get up sort of fairly early. And these walks, I mean, some of them were from John O'Groats to Land's End, for instance. And I joined him on one in the North Wales sort of region. He would get up at 8:15, have a big breakfast. By 9, he was barking at everyone to get ready. And then 9:30 on the dot, we'd set off for our 30 miles a day, and it was going to be round about that every single day. And we'd set off at an absolutely furious pace. He would walk at close to 4 miles an hour, which is, for me, almost a jog, actually. It's a really, you know, fast pace. But he would keep that up, and they'd send a van in front with big loud speakers on it saying, "Beefy's on his way. He'll be here in 10 minutes, 15 minutes time. Ladies and gentlemen, get your money out. You know, be ready." And incredibly, people would line the streets. You know, it was like being with the Pied Piper or something. We would be a group of, I don't know, 15 of us walking with him. We'd all carry these buckets, which were there to collect the money. People would line the streets, on not only in the middle of towns, but on the outskirts as well. They'd come out of their houses and wave at us and throw money at us, or, you know, put the money into the collection buckets. If we'd sometimes go through an area where there were some older people living and they couldn't get down to the street side, maybe they'd wave from an upstairs window and beckon the collectors up to their front door and, you know, toss the money out of the upstairs windows. You know, it was an extraordinary experience, and that would continue for 6 hours until we reached our destination, our next stop-off point, so, you know, 30 miles later. No stopping for anything, lunch or a wee or anything like that, just absolutely just 100% momentum. We'd get to the end, and then it would be, for him, a massage, a sleep, a big dinner and a gallon of wine, go to bed at midnight, and then up again for the next day. Do that 30 days in a row to complete the distance. I needed a week off after one day with him. And he did that 16 times, not necessarily the same route, but that kind of commitment was extraordinary.
That does remind me actually of one thing about him, I suppose, that you could possibly say he could be perceived as a bit selfish in the way that he expected others to be able to perform like that after that much, you know, Falstaffian sort of carousing in the previous night. What worked for him didn't necessarily work for others. I mean, you're his teammate, so you know better than I do, but most human beings can't keep that going, can they?
No, which again is another remarkable thing about him. And, you know, that's why he's the Lord. He is, isn't it? And because of that total unadulterated contribution over really two decades to this particular cause, which really, you know, got into his heart and soul, and now his peerage will probably stem, you know, other kind of causes, I imagine.
Oh, he was already a sir, wasn't he? I mean, I did have this debate with somebody, and you know, he was already a sir. So, would the sir be for the cricket and/or the charity? I don't know. I mean, you know, let's for balance's sake acknowledge that there are people who aren't happy about his elevation to the House of Lords, and they don't like his views on Brexit, and they don't like the fact he shoots things, and you know, so he's become a bit of a Marmite figure, unfortunately, which is a shame when you consider his charity work and what an absolute national hero he was in 1981.
Well, he was, and he's still someone who is making waves. This time, at the moment, he's got into his wine in a big way. And I know he talked to you quite a bit about that, about the sourcing of the wine from the Barossa Valley in Australia and Central Otago in New Zealand and Argentina and so on. He's a big fan of the New World wines. Botham wines, you can get them from any normal supermarket. They're stocked, you know, plentifully. It'd be a good time to get some actually over Christmas, I guess. So we've featured him in the Cricketer magazine prominently with your interview, Hugh, and one or two other thoughts as well from people. And it's got Beefy, of course, on the cover. It's out on Thursday, and you can go to thecricketer.com/subscribe or thecricketer.com website to become a subscriber of the magazine. So that's it. Looking back at an amazing career, and probably a lot more that he will achieve, actually, given that he's got plenty of time to do it. 65 is nothing, no age at all these days. It's incredible to think, really, that people did retire at that age. So look out for the Cricketer magazine. And also, don't forget our live video stream this Thursday night with Alistair Cook at worldsbestcricketclub.com. Subscribe to that and you can join us on Thursday night at 7 p.m. We've got lots of other guests lined up as well, including Ian Botham himself. And he's going to be busy actually with wine sales and also apparently 200 turkeys that they've been farming as well. So they're going to be a busy family, the Botham family, at Christmas. And of course, look out also for his grandson, James, playing against England for Wales on Saturday. And you can toast his birthday on Tuesday with some Beer 52 as well, some craft beer, if you go to beer52.com/cricket. Hope you can join us on Thursday for Alistair Cook. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.